Welcome to episode 55 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is October the 14th, 2012. I'm Matthew Dean Furlough, and this is my skydiving brother, James Furlough.
Yeah, hitting Mach speeds, and that's what we're going to do tonight. We have way too many stories, so we're going to go literally, you know, faster than the fastest free-falling guy on these stories.
Exactly. This is going to be the Felix Bumgarner of Furlough Bros episodes. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
Why not? But this week, like every week, we'll be talking about very quickly about technology and the continuing corporate opera, or the soap opera of corporations' dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and of course the technology that they develop and continue to developed, all tenses. Before we get into the heart of the show, James has a quick disclosure that he wants to throw out there, try to save his job.
Yeah, because I work for HP, but during this podcast, I don't even kind of represent HP, which if you listened to previous shows, you'll know to be true.
And it's true.
So anytime I'm talking about HP or HP stories, I should say HP instead of like I or we or something like that.
Yeah, the nice part about it is people can know confidently that our opinions are not tainted by... our allegiances.
The only real bias is when there's printing related news, I tend to pay attention, and I pay attention to HP, so we tend to talk about that more than I think other tech stuff would, you know, because yeah, I have a vested interest.
I don't think we've ever talked about Kodak.
Or, correct.
What are your other or Dell. Well, we talk about Dell every once in a while. But...
Every once in a while, but I'm sure that there's, you know, there's stuff out there about them, but, you know, I don't care, so.
Exactly. So, anyways, I gotta mention this before we start talking about articles, but if you want to follow us throughout the week, get all sorts of witticisms and interesting comments, you can follow me. My Twitter is at Matthew D. Furlough.
And I am at James Furlough, which I wasn't that awesome last week, but that's okay.
I tried. I had some that I thought were pretty good. Golden, maybe silver at least. You can also follow the show at Furlough Bros. Is the show Twitter. But if you don't like Twitter, you just like the internet in general, there's all sorts of places you can go, like Google Plus and Facebook, or just go straight to our URL, which is Facebook or Furlough. Face Bros.
Yeah.
Furloughbros.com. I don't actually have an IP address for you, but we'll figure it out and give it to you later. So if you don't even like URLs, we got options. So follow us. It's awesome.
Awesome. So Tesla's been in the news a little bit. And this one's, I love it. If you can't compete, call it illegal.
Yeah.
That's a strategy.
If you can't say what rhymes with litigate about competition? If you can't
I don't know.
If you can't compete, litigate. But there's a okay, go you continue. I'm gonna Google this. I know this is a comp, go for it.
Okay. Yeah, I'm ready. I'm waiting. So anyways, Tesla, their stores have been called illegal. So what they do is they follow the Apple model, basically, where because they're, you know, what is it?
If you can't innovate, litigate. Jeez. It's good. It's a good quote. If you can't innovate, litigate. So.
Okay.
Continue.
There it is. Scratch that itch. So, Tesla, in order to, you know, introduce people to their cars, has been following an Apple model where they are literally opening up stores inside of malls with cars inside so that people can go check them out. And since they're, you know, all electric, you don't have smog issues, I'm guessing, you know. So anyways, so they have these cars in there, and I don't want to say it's been successful. I don't know. This picture shows a lot of people inside of the building, so there you go. And this is in their Massachusetts store. But anyways, other car dealers have determined that what they're doing is illegal and trying to put a stop to Tesla.
What?
Yeah. So basically, what they're saying, let's see here. Apparently, they're protesting that Tesla has factory-owned stores, because apparently dealerships are not allowed to be factory-owned normally. From what I could gather from the article, it's kind of semi-gray area the way that it's worded, but they're kind of like, the understanding is manufacturers and factories don't own dealerships. They do franchises, and they're the ones who sell the cars. And
weird.
Yeah, and I'm just like, okay.
Well, I have to believe that was not designed to protect the manufacturers. That was designed to protect the franchises. You know, the franchisees.
Well, that's who's complaining. The franchisees.
Oh, the franchisers?
Yeah.
Okay, I thought GM was complaining. Hey!
No, it's the franchisees. But basically, they said that they're only doing it in certain states. It's not all of them. It's in 10 different states, and it's because the rules are written in such ways where in those 10 states they can get away with it, whereas in the others it sounds like they can't own it, which is just kind of weird. But you know, but Tesla's like, that's where the customers are. We want to show off our cars. We want to set up stores there, and we don't do the dealership thing.
I'll be honest. So I was I live in California, Bay Area. And there's this one mall type place. It's called Santana Row. If you're from this area, you know what it is. It's pretty swanky. But in their big parking structure at the bottom, as you're walking into the nice walking area, they literally have like four cars set up, kind of barricaded off. And when I went there, I showed up, you know, I was buying something from Best Buy or something. I don't even know.
Yeah.
Like, so I showed up in like t-shirt, shorts, sandals, you know, looking like a bum. And I'm like, oh, Tesla car. So I walk over. I'm like, oh, these look super nice. And, like, people are getting their pictures taken in front of these cars in, like, ball gowns and, like super cute girls. I mean, like, and, like, guys that looked like they were rolling with money. Like, I was like, oh, it was like you're in the middle of this parking lot. I mean, it's not a factory store. But it was like you're walking into an exotic car lot and, like, you were totally out of place. Like, oh, these pretty nice cars, right, everybody? I wish, you know, maybe I think about buying one. it's ridiculous. It's crazy. But I was blown away it very much had the feeling of an exotic car lot. Hmm. That same sort of, these are ultra nice, ultra performance cars, which is cool because I know that these new models aren't priced like exotic car lots.
Yeah.
Which means that you'll probably see, I mean, they're very expensive, but they're like expensive, like high-end luxury cars, not expensive exotic. You know, they're like, yeah. Anyways, but I was really impressed by the overall like feel of it. I was like, oh, this is pretty cool.
Which is harder to do with it's not necessarily harder. I don't know, but you know, regular dealerships are definitely not doing that. But I just think it's funny how, you know, here's Tesla coming out with an innovative way to reach out to customers, and I don't even know if I'd call it innovative, a different way of reaching out to customers and showing off their vehicles, and my guess is that they're starting to be successful, and they just come back and go, whoa, 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 you're factory owned. Yeah. We don't do that here. Okay, this is America. It doesn't work that way.
Which is fine. Which means what's going to happen is Elon Musk's brother is going to suddenly own a bunch of franchises, you know.
I don't know. Well, and Tesla comes out and they're like, we're not trying to be jerks, okay, we're not trying to hurt you and, you know, kill the dealership. industry. That's not our intent. We're just trying to sell cars. Leave us alone. But
yeah,
you see that a lot in tech stuff, and you know, that is. Now there is a technology that has been getting a very warm reception, and it is, I love this title, the ultimate dead spot.
Yeah.
Yes. And I actually think this is a brilliant idea. Basically, if someone dies and they have a headstone.
Bummer.
And
yes.
And typically they have, you know, there's a story, right? Buried in the ground. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there's very little that you can say on the headstone other than maybe one, you know, you get like a line or two to say something about the person, and that's it. And
yeah.
And it means something to you, but some stranger walking by, you go, oh, okay. You know, he was a great husband and father. Wonderful. I mean, that's, you know, that's great, but you know what I mean? It doesn't have that impact.
Yeah. You sort of downplayed that one. Oh, great. That's all he was, a great father and husband. Yeah.
Wonderful. So this company has come up with an idea where I don't actually think they've come up with it. They're just being successful at it, where basically you can buy QR code plaques to put on the headstone. So when you're walking through a cemetery, you get your smartphone, click. It's linked to, I'm guessing, a website where that could have, you know, any type of media on the web. It can have a video of the person. It could, which it would be weird if the person's like, if you're watching this, you're standing on me. But, you know, you could have that.
I totally want to do that now. It's
awesome. But, you know, but you could do videos. You can do pictures. You can, and they were saying that, like, family members, theoretically, it's a website, so you could do whatever you want, right? Family members could add information to it, add pictures as they find it. They could make comments. They could share stories, whatever. The point is you can make it so that, you know, if you're just walking through a cemetery, you know, because you got time to – oh, I almost said time to kill. yes.
Cemeteries. People are dying to get in them.
Man.
You thought you were going to make it through that story without me dropping that joke.
Yeah, we were close. Anyways, so, yeah, I just think that's kind of a cool idea. You know, something where I was like, oh, I wouldn't mind having something like that. And, you know, where someone could go and just see who I am and, you know, learn more about who somebody is and whatever. I think that's cool.
Yeah, that's really cool. That is very neat. I mean, you know, at this point, you could probably just Google the person if they have a website, but I like the encouragement of it, and it's, you know, yeah, it's kind of this sweet, you know, way to remember. And what'll
and
be
maybe,
nice
maybe
about it is...
maybe strangers isn't the way to think about it. It's like family members. You can go there, click it.
Right.
You can watch a video of your loved one and go, oh, yes, that's right. That's what they look like.
Yeah, and what I was gonna say was, you know, it's, you know, that digital archive aspect of it, you know, it's you can't. I mean, as much as we freak out about how much information Facebook is collating, they're not gonna hang on to everything forever. So it actually allows you to, you know, if you kind of get into this whole idea of a digital archive, where your information and your, you know, who you are, like that can be, you know, linked to that specifically, and so. You know, you come, oh, this is my great-grandfather, you know, four generations later.
Yeah, there's still there you go.
UR code that you can, you know, that you can use your super high fancy, you know, your optical implants can read, you know, and you can be surfing the web through your brain, because I'm assuming that's where we'll be in those many generations.
Well, I mean, I know that's one of the reasons why one of many reasons that I blog, you know, so that it's something that I own that, you know, theoretically someday my kids could read it and be like, oh, that's what Dad was like when he was young and stupid. Cool.
Man, you're boring.
Yeah, really. You know what it is? I'm going to be like, you should read this. It's amazing. It's my life. And they'll be like, yeah, I'm just going to go play video games. I'm really not interested. I'll be like,
yeah.
No!
I did this for you! Yeah.
Oh, it's totally how it's gonna be. It's gonna crush me. I already know it, but it's not gonna stop me because it's only one of many.
Right. Well, and the rest of us appreciate it. So, kind of taking a lighter turn. So, Microsoft gets a bad rap for Windows having some having some security flaws occasionally. And
It's been known to
they
happen.
usually it's because of stuff that they've done or Adobe's fault. But it's rarely ever Apple's fault that there's a major security issue on a Microsoft, which is pretty impressive considering the fact that, iTunes is pretty much on most Macs now or most PCs nowadays. It's a secure system, but we got one specifically brought to you by Apple. This is awesome. So we brought this story to you a couple, well, it's not, it's a little bit unfair. So we brought this story to you a couple weeks ago that Apple is purchasing a biometrics company, one of those guys that they you scan your finger and it's a little chipset. He scans your finger,
Yeah.
allows you to link. And the thought was that they're going to integrate it into an iPhone that'll have near field communication for purchasing the stuff, so authentication. Well, these guys have been making these biometric chips forever, and they're built into all sorts of PCs. So if your PC has a little biometric thing where you scan your finger, there's a really good chance it was made by this company, now owned by Apple. By the way, nobody's alleging that this is Apple's fault, actually.
Okay.
But basically, how the thing worked is it would like, it would link to your code, to your password. And so basically what it does is when it sees you, it would put your password into Windows, and that's how Windows would move forward.
Okay. Makes sense.
And so it's a pretty simple system. The thing is that it ended up recording your password in your encrypted password in your like System 32 folder, which like you can get to through like a little booting off a Linux off of a jump drive, and the encryption that they use is super easy to crack. So
Sweet.
basically, any computer with one of these biometric things, you pop in a joystick, you turn the computer on, or not a joystick, a thumb drive, you turn the computer on, like literally 13 seconds later, they have your password, they've logged into
Well,
Windows.
so do I have to have used the thumb scanny thingy?
Yes,
Okay.
you actually have to set it up.
All right. I'm okay then.
Yeah. It's like this massive security exploit, and it's a day one flaw in pretty
Awesome.
much any computer that uses them. Yeah, it's one of those amazingly horrifying things. You're like, I can't believe that this happened.
But the
Like, how did
person
you not
has
do
to
this?
actually have your computer.
Yo, yeah, you can't. I
Okay.
mean, but if
It's
you
not
left
like
your
you
com
can set up a remote hack in it and get, millions of passwords overnight. That kind of thing.
But it's super simple, and
Yeah.
the ability to get it is already growing widely in knowledge. So,
Awesome.
good times. If you have one of those,
Don't use it.
there's no fix yet. I'm assuming one will come relatively soon. If I manage to catch the anything talking about it, I'll definitely bring it to you. But just don't let anybody else play with your computer if they look suspicious.
Got it. You're
You'll have
never
your
touching
code
my
in no
computer.
time.
Sweet. All right, ready to have your mind blown?
Yes.
See, we told you guys, this is hard-hitting, fast journalism right here. Are we jur- No, we're just we just have a lot of cool stuff. Okay, on Quora, there was a thread that I saw, and I love Back to the Future, so we're going to talk about it.
Oh, baby.
The question, is there a version of Marty McFly wandering around aimlessly in the 1950s? The guy goes, because here's the timeline. Okay, ready? First, we have Alpha Marty, Marty number one. He's born in the 70s, in the 80s, he goes back to the 50s and goes through the events of the first movie. When Alpha Marty returns to the 80s from the 50s, we see a second, we'll call him Beta Marty, go through the events with the terrorists and then travel back to the 50s. Assuming that Doc in the 50s realizes that the events of Alpha Marty were successful, he should be against linking up with the Beta Marty.
Right.
Therefore, he wonders if there's a Beta Marty who's trapped in the 1950s with virtually no help from anyone. And then he goes, a more morbid theory would be that Doc would kill him to fully preserve the success of Alpha Marty. And it's so you're like, okay, let me wrap my head around what just happened here, right? Because
yeah, well, it totally makes sense because you saw Marty McFly go back in time,
Alpha Marty.
And the assumption
yeah.
is he just would go through whatever he was doing, but that's not necessarily true. Because things already happened.
Yeah. You know, which I've seen, like, people have done chalkboards before, right? Of, like, here's how the timelines would work. And it's, you know, it's nuts. So this guy, who's a casual physics fan, he writes back and goes, no, Beta Marty is not wandering around aimlessly. Like, all right.
Oh, thank goodness.
Here we go. He goes, Beta Marty travels back to November 5th, 1955, before 50s Marty's doc has had the experience of working with him.
Which is my first thought.
Yep. Doc would absolutely still be the first person that Marty turns to, and Doc at that point in time that Marty returns to has no knowledge of him. Right? We're
right.
All still good. Okay. But he goes, now here's the real question. Beta Marty has had a completely different set of life experiences due to completely different parenting. Chio, that's legit, right?
Right.
He gives points here. Alpha Marty grew up with a father who was, you know, not very good at confrontations. Beta Marty grew up with a father who was a successful writer who occasionally told the story of how he defended Lorraine's honor. Beta Marty has a completely different story of how his parents met than Alpha Marty. Does Beta Marty wind up more or less repeating the new changes that Alpha Marty introduced, or does Beta Marty take steps that reverse the changes that Alpha Marty introduced? And I actually really liked his conclusion here. He goes, perhaps after meeting George in the diner, Beta Marty witnesses the confrontation with Biff. But he knows, however, that George will stand up to Biff within a week. So Beta Marty decides to get out of the way, lest he interfere with what he terms history, at least as he knows. He's known it, right? Because all he has is a dad story. He parts ways with young George at the diner and then retreats to Dog's place immediately. So that means that he isn't in place to save George from getting hit by Lorraine's dad's car, which sets into motion the original timeline. Beta Marty stays quietly out of the way at Doc's house with the whole week, having no further interactions with his parents. Lightning strikes at the clock tower. Beta Marty returns to 1985. He returns to the 1985 that he set up, the 1985 that Alpha Marty left. Beta Marty, who grew up with great parents and successful siblings, returns to find his family pretty miserable. So basically what he says is that they will be locked in an ever-circular battle. You know,
they'll be oscillating back and forth between timelines for the rest of time.
Yep.
If time has any meaning.
Yep. And then I do like his, he goes, perhaps the switching of their intertwined lives also explains why Jennifer looks like Claudia Wells in part one and Elizabeth Shue in part two.
Yeah, I believe it. This is my only point of optimism, because I completely agree with his conclusion that that's exactly what would happen. And I feel really bad for Beta Marty, who basically would come back to time thinking he didn't change anything, but accidentally ruined his family and couldn't figure out why. And the only thing I can think is that they named Marty after Marty. So it's possible that Beta Marty grew up not only with the stories of how his dad defended his honor, but also Calvin Klein, a.k.a. Alpha Marty, who was through the story. And maybe as soon as he gets back in time, all of a sudden he realizes, and this would have been a trip had they done this. But they couldn't know. I mean, it's just too complicated. But if all of a sudden he realizes, wait a second, they talked about Marty. I'm Marty. Maybe I've been here before. Maybe I need to get involved. And now all of a sudden, not only does he have to also figure out how to not only can he not mess anything up too much, but he also has to figure out what Alpha Marty did in order to make sure everything went the way it went, so that Alpha Marty and Beta Marty both have the same experiences, so that he does what Alpha Marty did and nothing more, which is really mean to Alpha Marty in retrospect to have messed him up like that. But and then you just have perpetual Beta Martys, because every time Beta Marty would come back, he'd see a Marty having his same experience as Travel. Or this would have made like the longest movie ever, as things just like butterfly affected further and further out of control until
that'd be interesting
the end of
time.
Too.
Yeah, like a game of telephone.
Exactly. That's actually a really good. Oh man, I feel like you could make an entire movie series off of that. Just like start at the end of Beta Marty going back in time, and you could have totally new actors, but just do it like as this. Now he has to go back and play the game of figuring out what this other Marty did. And you could have, and Doc would figure it out. Doc would realize what happened when,
smart
you know.
Guy.
Yeah. And so you could have it be him, like them trying to figure out, what will we have done next? I don't know. Well, I don't know.
I don't know.
That would be great. That would be great. All right. I like it. I like it. Or maybe Beta Marty, once he figured out if he survived, presumably he would survive. Maybe he would go back in time just a little bit earlier than expected so that he could catch Alpha Marty and say, hey, what did you do? Because I need to go back and redo it again. This is going to be crazy. All right, I'm going to stop making a movie and go back to the tech podcast, but I like it. That's brilliant.
There were two comments. By the same guy, actually. His first one, which I thought was great. He goes, great, Scott. I've seen that movie a zillion times, and that never occurred to me. Heavy. and then he does say, but wait, the 1985 doc that sends Beta Marty back is the same doc that helped Alpha Marty in 1955. So he presumably knows that Marty's intervention was necessary to set the happy McFly family timeline in motion. He definitely knows what the plan was in 1955, and he probably later learned that George rescued Lorraine from Biff. Maybe that doc actually coached Beta Marty on what he needed to do in 1955, and then, unlike the first time around, sent Marty McFly back to 1955 on purpose, which actually kind of coincides with what you said.
Right.
So, there you go. He could have had help before he even got there and didn't actually have to figure it out.
Yeah. That would make my movie a lot less entertaining, but more logical.
All right. Well, you know, that's why you got to love the internet, right? People have time to think about this stuff. You're just like, oh. Oh, it's great. That movie.
Yeah.
They left it just nebulous enough that you could just have hours of fun with it.
Oh, yeah. It's a great movie. It really is.
So how do you know if you're on the internet right now?
Usually because I'm, well, am I awake?
So
actually,
yeah,
am I
really
asleep?
So you'll like this. There was a story written by the Owl, AWL. It's a handy test for Reddit users because they had this privacy issue this last week. And it was, how do you know if you're on the internet right now? Okay. So it's a seven question test, I guess. So you got to find out, where are you right now? Do you see the words Microsoft Word anywhere on the screen you're typing in? Then you are not on the internet.
It's okay. True.
Is your computer turned off? Then you are not on the internet. Are you typing in an email or a chat? Then you are on the internet, but you have some level of expectation of privacy. People can't Google your emails or IRC rooms, but people can forward or publish what you say there. So you're almost on the internet. Let's see here. Are you on a website, message board, network, or other web-based purveyor of images and words? You are on the internet, which is in public. Everything you type there can be found through the magic of having eyeballs and scrolling fingers, and it can be assembled. Okay.
Yeah, not to mention, most of that is all crawled as well by a Google, you know,
yep,
stuff, so that it's easy to search.
Number five, can you see the words Warcraft anywhere? Then you are on the internet, but in a gray area.
Weird.
Have all your luzzes here. No one can see you but some guild of pastry nerds.
Did you just call them luzzes?
I did.
Not lulls?
I did.
Jeez. All right.
Number six, are you texting? Not sure what that is.
Yeah, that one's weird.
It is weird.
I think texting is clearly private, but our government treats it like it's not, which is terrifying.
It's weird. And then finally, number 7, can it be upvoted? Beware, you are definitely on, quote, the internet.
Yeah.
There you go. That's how you know if you're on the internet.
You know, honestly,
there are some weird gray areas.
Like I said, it's actually probably easier just to go to question number 1. Am I awake? I'm on the internet.
I am probably on the internet.
Am I asleep? Has my computer turned off automatically yet? Still probably on the internet.
Yeah.
So
I think I get to keep going for a couple more here.
Go for it.
Saturday Night Live did a show. When you're done listening to this podcast, or when you get home after listening to this podcast, go to Hulu.com, scroll down a little bit, or just search for Saturday Night Live. They did a tech talk about the iPhone 5.
Yeah.
It's awesome. Basically, they start out where they have different, you know, editors from the different tech magazines and stuff like that. You know, they're there, and they're like, so, what do you think about the iPhone 5? And one guy, you know, the first guy is like, so Maps is horrible. I absolutely hate it. It's bad. The next girl, what did she... I'm trying to remember what she made fun of. You know, she had some complaint. I actually don't remember hers. But then the next guy was like, he goes, it's too thin. It's too light. He goes, I know we said we wanted it to be thinner and lighter, but he goes, it's too much. Okay. I feel like I'm going to break this thing. And so then they go, all right, well, we have some special guests for you today. We thought that we would give you the opportunity to complain to the people who actually make your phones so that you can tell them what you think. So then it's 3 Chinese workers from Foxconn.
Oh.
I mean, you know, they're all SNL actors, right? But that's right. Who they are. And they're like, so, go ahead and tell them about your complaints. And they're just like, so, and all, you know, the editors are like, I don't want to. I don't know. This doesn't sound like fun anymore.
Yeah.
And they're just like, no, go ahead. Let us know. And they go, well, okay, the Maps app is not very good. It's not very accurate. And so they sit there and was like, one of the Chinese workers go, oh, so you tried to get directions to Starbucks and it sent you to Dunkin' Donuts instead? Oh, I feel so sorry for you. He goes, I don't have to use Maps since I work at the same place where I sleep. You're just like, ooh.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, total, like, they go right after the first world problems, you know? It's awesome.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, for one of them, there's like, the guy who was talking about how it's too thin, they're like, well, go ahead, voice your complaints. He's like, I don't want to. They're like, no, this is a safe environment. Go ahead. It's like,
this is a safe environment.
Yeah. He sits there and goes, okay. He goes, well, the aluminum, it scratches easily. And then all of a sudden you hear like one of them starts playing like a Chinese mandolin. Like a violin,
yeah.
Just like, wah, wah, wah. He goes, oh, don't worry about her playing, you know, playing the violin, and don't worry about my other colleague. Well, she does, you know, this whining dance. It's all fine. Keep going. It's fine.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's very funny. And then they do ask, they go, well, you know, you, here's how I'll get everyone to go watch it. They go, so, you know, Foxconn factory workers, do you have anything you want to complain about, you know, the American products? And their answer is awesome. So you will have to check it out. Yeah, it was,
right.
It was very, you know, from a tech perspective, it was awesome. You know, where they just totally go straight for the first world problems. It was great.
Yeah. I don't know. That reminds me of C.S. Lewis, not C.S. Lewis, Louis C.K., the comedian, as opposed to the theological writer. Louis C.K. It says his quote: "His everything's amazing and nobody's happy." Which, you know, man,
yeah,
same ballpark. That's awesome. I'll have to check that out. I
Yeah,
totally
it's
missed
funny.
that. That's hilarious.
Yeah, it's really well done. It was a good, I and you know how it is with SNL. You can't just watch one skit, and I would say there's more than one good one
Right.
this week. But yeah, that one's particularly good. Highly recommend it. So check it out. So I don't know who's in charge of NASA's Mars Rover's Twitter account, but they do a
Yeah.
really good job with it. I don't know if you follow him on Twitter at all. It's
No, I'll have to.
what is his Twitter handle? Here, give me a second here. I'll get it. Oh, Curiosity Rover. No, it's at Mars Curiosity. There you go. Search for either one. Curiosity Rover at Mars Curiosity. They do an excellent job of, I don't want to say it. Like a lot of times, they'll go, "Hey, just took this picture recently. Check it out." And those are fun. Or it'll be like it'll take a video and you can watch the video and it does that. But they also do things like it did this recent tweet where it goes, "I can do donuts on Mars, but it's just not the same. Endeavor, you're making me homesick." And then it's hashtag spot the shuttle. And then it's a picture, and it's a picture of the Endeavor in front of, it looks like Randy's Donuts, where it has, the big donut on the building.
Yeah.
And you're just like, that's cool. I mean, they really, really, they go way out of the way to what is it? Anthropomorphize? I can't say it.
Anthropomorphize.
Yeah, that's the one. To make it seem like it's, human and has a personality. I mean,
Right.
that's the style of all the tweets. It's all first person type of stuff. But yeah, but that's just, I think whoever does it, does an awesome job with it. And I think it's a cool way to, to keep people interested in, what's going on with the space program. So I mean, that tweet itself, you're like, all right, whatever. Just being goofy. But I think that's a great thing that they do, and I would love to see more companies maybe, be that casual about it. I mean, you think about who are the
Yeah.
people running NASA. They're a bunch of science geeks. They're gonna have fun with it, and we naturally go, ha ha, that's cool. And they
Yeah.
don't care too, it doesn't have to go through lawyers, and I don't think so, at least, lawyers and be all PC and gotta, keep the integrity of the brand. They're just, but I don't know, you see like Comcast Cares. They are ones who really, they went a
Yeah.
different tactic, but also made it very real and, also entertaining in a way. And
Yeah.
it's like, it's cool. Good job, guys.
That
Keep
is
it
very
up.
cool.
I'll
I
keep
like it.
following.
Hey, Chubney, I said, I want your budget back, just as bad
Yeah.
as you do.
Okay,
Okay, I
cool.
hate to do this because we're
Do it.
about to dive into stuff I get to talk about. One of the downsides of not having a commercial breaks is that if you absolutely need to take a minute-long break, you don't actually have them. But I absolutely need to take a minute-long break. I'll be right
We
back.
will take a minute-long break.
All right, be right back.
I'll figure it out. So, MLB fans, huh? How about you guys? Anyone here baseball fans? Yeah. The Giants doing pretty well. A's are unfortunately out. I have no clue how the Mariners are doing. That's how bad I am. But anyways, the MLB, they have a new baseball app out there. I don't know if it's new or not. I actually don't think it's new. But they have recently integrated with the iOS 6 Passbook. And what it sounds like is that people are huge fans of those Passbooks, which is kind of cool. They said that so far, they have had an adoption rate of like 12% of people going to the games are using Passbook. So, a digital version of the ticket in order to watch, games, which is cool. And they fully expect that by next season, it'll be all the way up to 90% of people using their digital, passes, which I think is very cool. But here's what is also super interesting about the fact that the majority of people are going to start using those digital tickets to go watch baseball games. They're finding that it is actually increasing the value of paper tickets for memorable games, because there's just less of them out
Ooh.
There. Yeah, and I mean, it's one thing like, oh, take a screenshot of your passbook. I was there. It's another to be like, no, I have the actual ticket of when he did that no-hitter or they won the World Series or whatever.
Yeah, seriously.
But yeah,
game, by the way.
Yeah, it's just interesting to see those, you know, unintended consequences, I suppose, of you know, digital goods. So what they're saying is like a lot of people, they will buy the ticket, or you know, if they have like season passes, they'll keep the tickets at home, just in case. You know, keep them in mint condition because those are super valuable, and then they'll just use the digital one for the actual game. But yeah, they're predicting that 90% of their tickets, you know, in the entrance will be digital passbook style next season.
By when?
Next season.
Next season. Whoa.
Well, they said it was already at 12%, just from passbook.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's cool. That'll change stuff. That'll save a couple trees, if nothing else.
Yeah.
That's cool. That's very cool. All right.
Makes it harder to scout, too, which I think they like.
Yeah, definitely. All right, so I'm going to jump right in on this one. I'm going to go backwards, so just keep up with me.
Okay.
So you know what Moore's Law is, right?
Yeah, every couple years, something doubles.
Wow. Nice job. Every 18 months, the number of transistors on a chip doubles.
Yeah,
and
that's what
I said. He made this prediction in the 80s, and it's basically what it actually was. It wasn't necessarily a prediction so much as it was an observation of what was happening. And later, somebody else came and took Moore's observation and said it's more, you know, and coined it as Moore's Law. He actually always was like, oh, don't call it that, because he's a modest dude. But it's held true. Every 18 months, processing power, data storage, RAM size, all those things have generally doubled, like clockworks, you know, a little more, a little less, but more or less, that's been the case. And pretty much without exception. And the cool part about a computer is because there's so many different aspects of everything, your graphics card, your RAM, your hard drive, everything that kind of goes with it. Not only have you seen each one double, but there's kind of been an exponential explosion of capabilities because each one is doubling,
yeah.
Which is really exciting. But this is there's a new world of quantum computing that has been endeavored in the last decade, and a man, his last name is Rose. He made an observation much like Moore's, and basically what he said was, if you chart growth at the beginning of the decade when we had our first quantum bit, you find that it's a sorry, what's his name, Geordie Rose, he's Dutch, I think, maybe not, I don't know, doesn't matter. Anyways, the important part is basically what he said was, if you chart growth and when you start in 2002,
he's a professor at Oxford. Is that where you were?
What?
He's a professor at Oxford, which I think is not Dutch, but that's okay. Keep going. You're fine.
Yeah, I was moving on.
I won't.
In 2002, we had our first quantum bit, and every year after that, every 12 months, we've doubled the number of quantum bits that we've managed to actually build. So we had our first quantum bit at the beginning of the decade. And I remember about reading about it in high school or college or whatever, wherever it was. By 2006, we were up to like four. By 2010, 2011, we were at 128. And as of last month, we have processors with 512 quantum bits. And so it's actually doubling every year, which is highly accelerated compared to Moore's Law. I mean, it's just a lot faster. But what's crazy about quantum processors is they kind of because of how they work, it's actually – you can't just compare component to component. You can't say one transistor is not equal to one quantum bit. A quantum bit – actually is exponentially more powerful. So if you have two it's like having 4 transistors.
Huh.
Or if you have 3, it's like having 9 transistors. So what they said was, you're actually having the number of processor, or the what ends up happening is the amount of processing power of each one of these chips isn't just doubling, which is a really fast growth rate. It's actually growing exponentially.
Yeah, that's huge.
In processing power. Yeah, it's unbelievably huge. It's so huge that it's predicted by 2015.
That's coming up.
We will have, yes, it's pretty soon. We'll have competitive performance with classical computers, which is, you know, pretty cool. One chip can do what a laptop can do. You're like, congratulations. Yeah, that's all right though. By 2016.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out, like, so I could use, let's say I had to, you know, a data set. I could choose to use a laptop or a quantum computer, and the output would be the similar. Is that what that means? Or are they doing the same amount of time?
So quantum computers basically, so for certain tasks, there are certain tasks that quantum computers are awful at, like internet browsing. There are other certain tasks that they're great at, like, for example, traversing an array. So let's say you have an array of phone numbers, and you want to find the phone number. A classical computer will look at each row. A quantum computer looks at all of them simultaneously and just outputs the path of least resistance, which is the right answer. And so...
This could be amazing for self-driving cars, which is super data intensive.
This is going to be huge. By 2050, actually, it looks like, sorry, I got that wrong. According to Rose's Law, by 2015, quantum computers will be faster than all computers on Earth. It's late 2013, they'll be comparable to classical computers. But because they increase exponentially, by 2015, they'll be faster than all classical computers on Earth. And by 2016, if you were to take all the mass and energy of the universe and turn it into one gigantic computer, our quantum processors will be faster, will be more capable of sorting and traversing arrays than a classical computer. Now, one of the things to remember is that this is sort of like 1930s-esque in that these things are like gigantic. They have to be super cold, and they're these huge boxes. It's crazy. It's completely nutty. Like, we're not talking – this is not the sort of thing that in the next decade – is going to reach consumers. But what we are saying is that within the next decade, by 2020, they will be able to do certain tasks that all the compiled power of Google servers, they couldn't do it in the same amount of time. Like, for example,
That matter, in the same amount of room in terms of materials required, servers and stuff.
Like, for example, this machine will be able to find the, let's say you put in a search request and it wants to find the closest search the closest search result.
Yeah.
This thing will be able to do it faster than all of their servers combined, which means it'll be able to handle an awful lot of requests. The same thing will go for what's called the traveling salesman problem. And I think we've talked about this on the show before, but it's basically the idea that there is no algorithm that we know of. Like, let's say you want to go from point A to point B on a map. Your traveling salesman is the example, and you need to traverse the roads. There's no way to find the shortest path that we know of outside of solving for every path and then solving for the shortest route.
Yeah.
See, that takes a lot of processing power. In order for Google to basically find the shortest path, they have to make tons and tons and tons and tons of assumptions. It takes crazy numbers of computers. A quantum computer, simply in one step, for one count of the clock, will just traverse every possible path and return the shortest path, which is a pretty efficient way to do it, considering the fact that everything else we have is absolutely horrible, which means that eventually we'll build quantum computers that literally just contain the entire map of the world, and every time you search, how do I get from home to work, it'll simply check every possible route everywhere in the world in return the shortest possible path.
Yeah, let you be literally real time, whatever's.
Yeah, which is pretty exciting. And what's going to happen is what you're going to see is you're not going to see quantum computers. You'll never have a quantum computer, probably, or you might have it like, you know, sufficiently advanced technology 60, 70 years from now, because there's all sorts of different things that go into it, from power consumption to temperatures. So it's not simple. But in 60 years, maybe we'll get to the point where you'll plug one into your computer like it's a graphics card, as an additional processing unit for certain types of tasks.
I think it'll still be housed in a server farm somewhere. You know, but, and we'll just be doing remote requests. But
yeah, more than likely, that's the solution. But what's really exciting, what's super exciting about this, is, number one, there's a company, they're called D-Link. They're actually selling these things. This isn't just people in a lab. This is viable product. And number two, by the end of the decade, it's more than likely that Google will have quite a few of them. And not just Google, but Apple and Amazon and Yahoo and everybody else who wants to compete in this realm. Because very soon here, they will be incredibly cost efficient compared to buying giant server farms. Makes sense. You'll always need server farms just for handling requests and whatnot. But in storing data, there will always be a balance between them. But these things will greatly enhance the certain tasks that really are going to help us, you know. Yeah, are going to help us. It's cool. It's exciting. It's fun.
So they're not going to take over the world or anything. This is not going to get us towards a singularity.
Probably not. Well, it'll help a little bit, but
right. Okay. Okay.
But it's just cool.
Then so I Rose's say Law. Full bore. Let's do it.
Yeah, Rose's Law. Just keep that one in your back pocket. She's coming.
She's coming. Cool.
Huh. Yeah. So this last week there was kind of. Did you follow the New York Stock Exchange at all this week, James?
As a general rule, I do not follow stocks at all. Period. I am a long-term investor, so I don't care about stock performance. Other than when it's like HP and there's a huge drop and, you know, everyone stops working to talk about it, then I pay attention.
And you know what? I'm going to give you an article that gives you all the more reason to not pay attention.
Yes!
And not invest. So basically this last week, they're calling it a mysterious algorithm.
okay,
but
that helps.
It basically was a remote request where – what happened was they had a remote server that was asking for quotes, and it asked for ever greater number of quotes until somebody noticed something was wrong. And basically what was going on was they started kind of small, but they started getting bigger. And every time they'd ask for the quotes, they would always cancel the transaction. So they never actually made a purchase on anything. And this kind of all goes back to, like, you know, questions about the micro crash 2 years ago and some other fluctuations. Things that happen with in regards to these, and one of the, like, the micro crash, they don't know what happened. The suspicion is, and this is widely accepted, but they're just not positive, but basically what they think happened was, as stocks started to dive, automatic triggers for selling started to be, you know, it got below a certain point, so things sold off. And the really sensitive ones, the high price, there was a 1% dip, so people sold. Well, that drove the stock lower. And then as all of these computer systems started to go, they all started just dumping their stock in an automatic fashion until there's just this giant crash that left this really, really low dip. Well, at the same token, there's all these triggers that say, hey, if it ever gets below this point, put this much money into the stock, which caused it to instantaneously start to jump back up. And like in a half hour period, I think it was Apple's stock was one of the big ones, took like a 30% dip in correction until it was like back to normal. Yeah. It was like the freakiest thing ever. Well, this week they had a similar one, but no actual purchases. And it was an unknown trader. They're still trying to track down what was going on. But basically what the suspicion is, what this was, is the goal was not to actually make any purchases, make any trades. Their goal was actually to suck up as much bandwidth as possible. Because what the theory is that for long distance traders in other parts of the country, in other parts of the world that are engaging on the New York Stock Exchange, if you can create effectively what is a distributed denial of service attack, or where you slow down the internet for everybody else, you can create small gaps of speed if you're actually on the floor or in the building or nearby. There's so much bandwidth around the New York Stock Exchange that if you're really, really close and your servers are really, really close, your request will still get accepted. But if you can load up enough requests, you can actually slow everybody else in the world down, which means that you're getting stock prices before everybody else. So you can slow down the internet, basically slow down the internet at the New York Stock Exchange, and say, okay, this thing's really low. It's about to – you start making purchases right as other people start to go, oh, I need to purchase that. But your request gets serviced first because you're local, as opposed to people that are further away that are getting drawn down by this by this attack. The New York Stock Exchange has no idea how to fix it or how to make it better.
But there you go.
Yeah, so that's awesome.
What they need is a beta Marty to help out.
They what?
They need a beta Marty, yes, to help out.
Exactly.
Wow, that's very interesting. So, I mean, I guess it makes sense. I'm still trying to figure out, I guess, when you're probably talking about the volumes that they're talking about, pennies matter. Mm-hmm. Because I'm just like, okay, if I gain a couple milliseconds, or I don't know, maybe it's a couple seconds of time because I gummed up the tubes.
You it know, could be enough. Well, yeah. The thing is, what they're
saying.
Well,
my initial thought was to say, okay, if I make a huge trade request, maybe that bumps up a stock price for that half a second, because the trade request came in, stock price bumps up. I sell my stock, it cancels the orders, stock price falls back down, but I got it in that tiny window there. Made a profit, no one else cared. That was my initial thought, and if I were doing it, that's how I would use it, and it would be an accomplice to, it'd be, whatever.
Yeah. But, and the thing is that micro trading on the New York Stock Exchange is such a powerful factor. It's such a predominant thing where everything is automated, and you basically have computers running against each other, and people try to create better and better and tighter algorithms to squeeze out, like you said, a couple pennies on a stock, but they're doing million stock orders, and all of a sudden, at the end of the day, you've made $100,000 because you outsped everybody else's algorithm. Which is what, it's terrifying that controls so much of the New York Stock Exchange that it can actually cause these big dramatic shifts in the stock price. It's not theoretical. We see, they can in an automatic, very, very rapid fashion, all of these different systems can really wreak havoc on stock price. So if you can control that in a certain way, or at least stack the odds in your favor, that could be very valuable. And what's really scary about it is that not necessarily that this type of attack will be effective or even used, but it's the thought that people are trying to figure out how to game the system and stack it in their advantage.
That's nothing new, right? I mean,
well, it's nothing new, but the thing is that for most of the history of the New York Stock Exchange, you're talking about gigantic amounts of money, and people are gaming and people trying to figure it out. But up until about the 90s, everything moved so slow that really had to outsmart people, and actually the best strategy was just to make good investments. And even if you're doing it rapidly, still the best strategy was to make good investments. Now it's not about good investments. Now it's about watching for a micro crash,
forcing it, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's no longer like you can't. And I guess what the point is that for you and I, maybe it's fun to watch somebody else, but if this is your investment strategy, you need to realize that you're being outgamed by people with, howitzers, and you're walking around with a little handgun because you've got your internet stock trading. You are outclassed in every way, and the only way you're going to make money is A, if you're a super long-term investor, or B, with a well-diversified portfolio, you're doing mutual funds, or B, you get stupid lucky. You know, people who do day trading, you know, for fun, you get a couple $1,000 in there, man, you are going to lose your butt.
Dude, don't tell me that. I would love to get into options trading, but yeah. But like you said, I'm not willing to put in the time and energy to A, create my own algorithms, and B, spend the time doing the analyzing and create something to do it. I'm just like,
right.
I know the returns are there, but I'm not willing to put in the, I'm not willing to invest time in order to get the monetary return.
Right. And it's just, it's such a, you know, it's just so clearly, I mean, I guess what my point is that every day that goes by, it seems like the New York Stock Exchange has always seemed like a casino where the house is stacked against you. But now it's like, now they're really, really, that you're not even playing the same game as them. If you're looking, oh man, Apple's going to make an announcement today, I'll buy in the morning when the stock is, you know, when or I'll buy right after the stock comes out when expectations are low. What are you doing? You're playing a different game than they're playing. playing with your money. That's the scary part. I don't know. So it definitely, I don't know, I get the feeling, makes me want to not be involved. Okay.
You should be, but do index funds, not mutual funds. Just want to clarify
that. All right. What are index funds?
Oh, man. I'm going to blow your mind. Index funds are the equivalent of mutual funds, but it's all run by a computer, doing it all automatically based on a set of rules. The major benefit of it is, A, you know exactly what you're getting because you can read what it invests in and what the portfolio mix that it's going for is, and it's an algorithm. It's not going to mess with it.
Yeah.
And the other really nice benefit of index funds is that since it's a computer, you don't have to pay extra fees in order to pay someone else to buy and sell stocks for you.
Nice. So, I do like that.
So, because they were actually saying the biggest hindrance of getting good returns are actual fees. So if you can simply figure out a way to reduce your fees in buying stocks, you will increase your returns more than being a good stock picker.
Don't tell me that. That's terrible.
Yeah, so don't worry. Our mom is... She uses index funds, so you're fine.
Oh, nice. Cool.
Yeah. No, I learned all about it and then went to our mom, who, if you're listening, she's a retirement specialist and helped us set up our retirement funds when we were wee little lads. And and so I learned all about this stuff and was like, oh my gosh, I got to get on the index funds. Called her up and was like, Mom, let's do index funds. She's like, okay, done.
Yeah, she's done that to me a few times before. Hey, Mom, have you heard
about
to
know
this?
Which one I got for you?
Yeah. That's awesome. That's cool. Yeah, it's good to know that the person that controlled most of our investments when we were young was paying attention. It's nice to know.
So anyways, but I'm now on a, people keep saying mutual funds, and they'll go, oh, it's the same thing. Well, yes, but
really.
No.
Yes, but no. The index fund is a subset of a mutual fund.
No, they do similar things. It's just one is run by a human, the other one's run by a computer.
All right, fair enough.
So,
there's
your finance lesson for the day.
So, it's interesting. So, James, have you ever gone online and thought, you know, we had that recipe for, I don't know, Jamaican jerk chicken a couple months ago, and it was really good, and you Google it and you can't find it? Have you ever had that experience?
Yeah, I guess I have. I mean, I have ways that can, you know, retrieve those types of things. But yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Have you ever clicked on saved a link on your computer and then clicked on it a year later only to realize that it was a dead link now?
Probably. I can't remember a specific example, but I've killed off links, so I know what happens.
So this is an interesting conversation that I was reading about. BBC brought this to us about what they call the decaying web. And we kind of think about, you know, he talk about like the idea of sometimes, you know, people put a video online and this is especially common with old politicians. Some embarrassing thing will go online and they'll get all upset about the fact that it's online and they'll want you to take it off. Get rid of this ad. And the quote that everybody always says is, trying to take something off the internet is like trying to take pee out of a pool. once it's there, you can't get it out.
Yeah, really.
And that's just been really true. Well, it turns out that it's only partially true. The internet, it turns out, is not as good of an archive as you'd actually like it to be. And sometimes things get lost. Sometimes important things get lost. And so this basically, they were talking about a big study. And what they said was, if you've lost something, you're not the only one. A study of tweets about six big events showed after 1 year. So you're talking big news events. So like the Arab Spring, big news events, not little things, but like worldwide, this is important kind of stuff. A study showed after six big news events showed that after 1 year, the network of links had decayed by 10%. Essentially, 10% of the links had died. A year later, only 41% of it was archived, so was going to be saved forever. And no, sorry, I said that wrong.
Was still
after 2 years, 27% of the links were dead, and only 41% of it was archived. And what they're saying is, and that's for things that we knew that these were important news stories when they were happening.
Awesome.
So like the Arab Spring, only 41% of it is going to be saved after 2 years, and a quarter, well over a quarter, of all the important information that was going on, that it will help us write history books and inform the futures, that's all gone. It doesn't exist anymore. People have deleted their pictures or killed the link, or it's not indexed anymore. It's non-searchable. It's gone. The network has been broken in that area. And basically what this article was pretty interesting, because it doesn't actually get into what to do about it. It basically just is, you know, it's good journalism. It's just presenting the problem. I don't know. I thought it was really interesting, because I had this experience. I had a personal experience with this, with Facebook, stupid Facebook. So my ex-fiance and I started our relationship probably a year or two or three after Facebook. Facebook was still kind of new, and so it was still very fun to kind of use Facebook as your like primary form of flirting, getting into the relationship. You're making an announcement. It's still a big deal, you know. And I wouldn't say, you know, we did the whole love letter things, like you're writing out, like, you have markers, you know, all that stuff. But there was a big aspect of it that happened on Facebook as well, commenting in each other's walls and messages to each other and all that stuff. And there was, we had this perceived archive of all of our stuff. You know, I was saving all of the notes that she had sent me. I had all those things in a box, and you hold on that kind of stuff. And for whatever reason, I just kind of assumed that the stuff on Facebook was going to be the stuff on Facebook. And I remember
Facebook's horrible about this too.
I know. Well, we was like 3 years later, and we decided to go and look back and just kind of being wax nostalgic on,
yeah,
you know, on what we had done, just to find that we only had like 6 months worth of wall posts that were archived.
Huh.
We were like, what the heck? And it was really upsetting, because there was no warning. There was no, hey, by the way, we're deleting this stuff. And there was no way to get it back. And it was like, you know, it was just, you know, at the time it was really heartbreaking. It was like, wow, we lost this. This is gone. I would have done something, and especially since they allow you to download your information, it's not like it disappears. It's not like it's unretrievable. If it's still live, and it was just gone, and I had no idea that it was happening. Interestingly enough, once Timeline came out, it all came back. They didn't even delete it. They just unindexed it. They unlinked it, nice. Which is like even more frustrating, because when you ask for it, they say, sorry, we can't get it for you, only to find out that it's, or it wasn't gone. It would just, they, you know, Facebook, sometimes the things you do, you know, this is important, man. But you know, you think about it, it's like, man, this goes back to you and your blog. You want to make it static. You want it to be something that doesn't go away with time. You want it to be something that you can hang on to, and, you know, yeah, you don't want it to go away.
Yeah, no, that's totally very true. I mean, and not even not go away, but be searchable and findable, you know, because that's what's still annoying about Facebook. Yeah, it's there, but good luck finding it.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're willing
that's
to
really scroll
through it. But yeah, no, I understand. It's an interesting conundrum. But then you even get other stuff where it's like, you know, and this problem is just going to get worse as time goes on. Because not because there's going to be more people creating content, but they're just going to be adding to it more and more and more and more. And
right.
I mean, who's to say that Google's still going to be around, you know, 50 years from now?
Yeah, it's I've got thousands of emails archived. There's no reason to believe that Gmail is going to be around, and it could, you know, it could be a 2-3 year period where they go from really strong to gone. You know, if something crazy, if all of a sudden, you know, searching through the web wasn't important anymore, like, I don't know, let's say somebody else decided to invest in quantum computing and they didn't, and all of a sudden somebody, they don't even have to have a good algorithm, they're just going to have better results, you know, or as good of an algorithm, but they can come up with comparable results, you know, something game-changing could happen. And if that does happen, what does that mean about these services, this information that, you know, I thought was important? You know, you think about YouTube, it's like, there's no reason for YouTube to assume YouTube will be around forever.
Yeah, there you go.
And there's so much archived information that really only Google could archive it at this point.
And you sit there and go, okay, it's one thing if it's my own video and they send me an email and say, hey, P.S., we're going out of business, you know, download this.
Right.
But it's another to be like, it's not my video. I can't. And the person who made that video died 20 years ago.
Right.
They're not going to save it. Now what? You know what I mean? That account is dormant for all I know.
Right.
What do you do?
And like this came up with is, it's, you know, it's one thing when you know it's important at the time and you hold on to it. But, you know, we talk about, you know, the big threat is be careful what you do on the internet, because in 50 years, everything you do will be public knowledge. And if you run for president, they can use that against you. And that's how you threaten kids into being safe on the internet. The thing is, what happens if somebody did do something really horrendous online and that information just goes away? You don't want that guy being president, but that information's gone. Like, there's a flip side to that, and that's not necessarily, you know, it's not necessarily given that what you want will be remembered and is searchable, you know, because you don't know what's important.
So yeah. I opened up that article on BBC. Did you read the little sidebar thing here?
No.
I'm gonna click on
Congress
it.
To archive every tweet.
Yep,
that one.
Uh huh.
Yeah, that's you know, it's funny.
That's one solution, right? You just brute force it. Okay, we will put the U.S. government will trust that they're not gonna go anywhere. Maybe we'll see. Historically, governments tend to change. But yeah, we'll trust that they'll save it for us and make it easily searchable one day, or at least, you know, give access to search engines.
It's so funny because you sit there and you go, like, you know, honestly, I remember when this article, when this thing came up and they were talking about it, I remember thinking at the time, why in the world are they getting into this? Like, why do they think that this is important? And now reading this, and actually I'm assuming that they were privy to these studies earlier than the rest of us. But clearly that's the problem, is that they're sitting here going, look, we've already – stuff that we thought was important is disappearing.
I still love that. I guess they're doing low-hanging fruit. Tweets are easy to save because it's all from a single source and 140 characters. Whoa. But you're kind of like, wow, that's the one we decided to go for first, huh? All right.
Yeah. Well, it makes – I mean, well, but the thing is that there's absolutely no way the Library of Congress could, I don't know, save everything on Google. You know, it's just like, you know, if you were going to go for it, it's really the only practical one. I mean, it's gigantic.
I guess I'll put all my important thoughts there, I guess. That's that one's backed up.
Hey, man, I do not do status updates anywhere except Twitter and just let it carry out the brute work of putting it everything everywhere for me.
There you go.
That's how I roll. So Thanks, Library of Congress. Everybody, that's right. All of my important thoughts will be stored, including my earlier tweet about a dream where I was naked.
I did see that and just went, yeah, I'm going to let that one go.
I was like, I woke up thinking, that was really weird. I was really all right with, like, you know, usually you think of, I don't dream very much. I almost never dream. So whenever I have a dream, like, if it's like a normal dream, I'm always like, weird. That's like, that's what people have been talking about all these years. Like, the falling dreams. I've had like two in my entire life. I'm like, weird. That's what people talk about. That's crazy. So I had like a naked dream where I'm like, oh, I'm naked in public. And I was just like, cool with it. I was like, I don't think that's how that was supposed to go. I think I was supposed to be awkward and like run home. Everybody's laughing at me, but I'm, whatever. I guess that's a good sign. Maybe. I don't know. But that will be saved in the Library of Congress. I get this weird feeling that that doesn't quite contend with the other things that are going on in the world. But whatever. Who knows? Maybe I'll be president one day. I won't be president one day. I don't want the job.
No doubt.
But, yeah, interesting. So I know you have another article, and I have one last thing before we just kind of go into the shotgun, talk about whatever. Do you want me to go or do you want to go? I'm going to get angry. I'm just giving you a heads up.
I'll go. So there was an article on the TechCrunch, and it is entitled "Angel Investors Do Make Money. Data Shows 2.5x Returns Overall." It's a response to another article written by Andy Ratcliffe, where he was saying that angel investors don't make any money. and so this guy was writing a response. Now, I have to give a full disclosure here. The guy who wrote this post, his name is Rob Wilbank. He is a PhD professor at Willamette University. I've spent many hours talking with this guy, and if I could figure out a way to spend more hours with this guy, I would do it in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
I mean, like...
Because let's clarify, because I don't think we've ever gone over this, but you got your master's at Willamette University, so in business administration.
Yeah.
So this isn't just we hang out and get coffee. We talk about business stuff. That's what I do when I hang out with him.
Yes. Yeah. He's a guy where I go, I've got a business idea. And he goes, well, let me hear about it. And then he proceeds to trash it for me, which is awesome. but he,
hey man,
but then
that.
He'll tell stories of other people and, you know, other stuff. And I love the way that he talks and the way he thinks about the world. One of his best quirks is like, he will flip from, I love the idea to I hate the idea, like instantly. And there's like rarely ever an in between. And,
yeah.
And if you have like a bad idea and you're like, well, I'm doing it anyways, 'cause you know, I love it. And his parting line, which always means you're going to fail, is, well, good luck with that.
Oh, that's rough.
Yeah.
Well, good luck with that.
but he's also very, like, he's very, you know, he's rational. Like I'll have an idea and he'll go, you know, he goes, you know what? You're not going to become a millionaire with this idea. He goes, but so what? Who cares? You're doing something you love. Hopefully you're making enough to put food on the table. Awesome. That's a success in my book. Who says that you got to become a multimillionaire off of your ideas? No one. You know.
Which is really optimistic, but yet at the same time, really deflating. But I want to be a millionaire.
that's what I thought it was when I originally told you about the idea.
Yeah. I thought this was genius.
Yeah, no, he's awesome, and he's taught me ways to evaluate businesses, which I apply. When I'm talking about business ideas with people, just super fun, super cool guy. Craziest driver I've ever driven with too. Which is pretty awesome. He's intense. He's the like honking the horn, flipping people off type of,
whoa, you know,
he's
okay.
That guy.
That's awesome.
So here's his logic. Just, I love it. We're just, whatever. We'll put it out there. he's like, as far as he's concerned, the rules are suggestions. And if you're willing to pay the fines for breaking the laws, go for it.
Hey, it's just a fee to do what no one else is allowed to do.
There you go. That's his thing. And he has a couple traffic tickets to prove it.
Yeah. Like,
every month.
Oh, man.
No, yeah, and driving with him, there was, you know, he did a couple things wrong. I don't think you can do that. He goes, I don't see a cop. All right.
I don't see a cop. Oh, man.
Anyway,
no. You ain't breaking the rules if you ain't getting caught.
All right. Let me build them back up. Those are just driving's one thing, you know. But I also love where he's like, he goes, you know, if I were a company, he goes, I would love to get charged with being like monopolistic and, you know, antitrust laws. He goes, because basically what they're saying is you've done so well, you have won by so much that you have literally destroyed your competition to the point where we're concerned about you. He goes, yeah. Is there no bigger compliment than that? You just killed everybody. Literally, they no longer exist. That's how awesome you are. It's like, dude, I would love that. That'd be so cool.
I'd say, that's the kind of problem I wouldn't mind dealing with.
Yeah. I mean, then he's like, well, then you got to move into things like, okay, how do you deal with that and maybe let someone survive in such a way where they're never really, you know, they're not a real contender, but, you know, you're still okay. But, yeah.
Because as we've seen, that's what Microsoft did with Apple, and it's been very successful. You know, they've never seen any competition from them.
Yeah, it's fine.
It's a great idea.
They still have the most, you know, the highest volume for personal computers or laptops and desktops.
What? You know what? In the area where they had a monopoly, they still have a monopoly. I will give them that.
Yeah, so it's worked out.
And
okay.
You know what? And honestly, I wouldn't mind being Microsoft. They're fine.
And I will say this. I don't know if he's going to listen to this or not, which is fine. But so here's how cool of a guy he is, okay? Like, I literally would be willing to take a pay cut to work with him regularly.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's just that kind of thing. Just because he's super smart, super fun. Yeah, that kind of thing. So there you go, right?
Right.
Anyways, so I wrote this article on, as you know, as a guest publisher for TechCrunch, which that in itself, you're like, that's kind of awesome, you know?
That is pretty awesome.
I don't think they would let me write anything on TechCrunch. he goes that he began studying angel. So he is, I'll read his little thing here. He's on the board of the Angel Resource Institute and is a partner with the Montlake Capital, which is a late-stage growth capital fund, and with the Revenue Capital Management, which is a royalty-based lender. And he's written a couple books and tons of academic articles. So his life is awesome. Basically, what he does is he teaches MBA students about strategy and how to evaluate companies.
Yeah.
And then when he's not teaching, he helps out these different capital investment funds groups to help them figure out who to invest in.
Nice.
And his pay is not a paycheck. He gets a small, you know, chunk of the pie.
Oh, baby.
So he has an incentive to do well. Yeah, I'm just
Which is why he can afford tickets.
Yeah, he's I'm just like, that's a pretty awesome job, actually. So so he's been studying angel investing for a while, and basically he goes, we've got this 10-year research that comes out that we've pulled together angel investors from both the UK and from the US and have determined that you actually do make money, and it's right in line with VCs. VC, you know, angel investors are not idiots. He goes, because what you find is that with an angel investor, they are a successful business person who recognized a good business opportunity and how to run a big good business and how to, you know, hire good people. So, of course, when they're evaluating companies, they use similar criteria. Successful people tend to make successful investments. there you go. but then he backs it up and says what they found was in any single investment, your chances of making your money back are less than 50%. He goes, but once you get to an investment portfolio of 6, he goes, then it turns to positive numbers. He goes, of course, the trick is that you have to treat each individual one as if it's your only investment that you could make. You know, you have to, right. you can't lower your standards because, oh, I'm going for 6 now, because once I get that, I'll be fine. You're like, no, you have to actually have the same high standard as if this is my only investment. It's a big deal. You know, right. Which is legitimately hard to do. But then he goes, what they found was in the UK and the US, they were very, very, very similar. So he goes, so in some ways we can say they're robust and, you know, universal in that regards. We don't have some sort of weird sample bias error. Because they were two separate studies that were combined, you know, to look together. But what he also found, so he found that the average return is, and he's always talked this way, and I think, you know, VC investors, he goes, it's a 2.5x multiple. In other words, your returns are 250%. Nice. And he said that it's about every 4 years is the average length of an investment. Okay. So you can think every 4 years you're earning 2.5 times your money, which I'm like, all right, that's better than what I'm earning in the stock market.
Do you want to make some angel investments?
Dude, that would be so much fun. Well, you get to talk to people who are, you know, hey, I got a brilliant idea. Cool. Tell me about it. And then you get to help them actually make it come true.
Which is really been the coolest part about this job, is getting to talk to startups getting off the ground, and you know, guys like Dana Severson from Wahooly, and getting to hear their dreams, and the idea of being able to help at all is really exciting when you hear a great idea, you know.
And then what he did say, though, is just like in VC investing, there is a it's one of those. Only like you only get your mega returns from like 10%. Not even. Mm-hmm. It looks like it's less than that. Your mega returns, it looks like it's like around 5 or 4%, maybe. Maybe it's only 1%. But the majority of like 50, somewhere between like 50 and 60% of the exits are, you lose money on them.
Right.
Right, which is the idea. If you just do one, you have more than 50% chance of losing it. It goes, but there's a lot of them, you know, they're like 35% of them that you do make some money, somewhere between 1 and 5x return. And he goes, and so, but what you find is that it's, yeah, on average, it's 2.5% or X, 2.5X. Right. That's an important distinction here.
it really is. It's about 100 times important.
Yeah, I love it. No, it's literally, if you invested $100,000, your return in, on average in 4 years would be $250,000. And P.S., the average investment is about $550,000. So you can start to do some math. So that's all you got to do. You got to come up with your first $500,000, and then in 4 years you can roll that into, you know, $1.25 million. Actually, no, because you got to do 6 investments in order to guarantee that you're going to get there. Never mind. Takes money to make money.
Depressing.
Yeah, that's how that works. But anyways, yeah, the investing world, I'm a, you know, numbers guy, finance guy. I always find that very interesting. So I thought it was cool how, you know, A, he's like, look, this guy was wrong, and I have data to back it up. So that's always fun too, but then it's cool just to, you know, to pull the curtain back just a little bit and go, no, here's what they're really doing. And this is why people get into investing and they don't do the stock market, because if you are good at evaluating people and ideas and markets, you don't just make a little bit of money,
right?
You make a number that the stock market goes, yeah, whatever, you know, it's a good year when we do like 12%. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a fantastic year.
Which is 1.12x your money, by the way.
Right. And that's, you know, That's Bernie Madoff type money if you're doing that in the stock market, which is another code for fake. Your money's being stolen from you.
Maybe you could do it with computers that are like hogging the bandwidth, slowing everyone else down, so you can take advantage of those windows.
Yeah.
Or you just do this, which actually sounds like more fun.
Yeah, really and truly it does. So.
Something's got you upset, huh?
Guess what? It's not iOS maps. I still give them a pass. I made the argument last week that the Maps app, although clearly has problems, that they're widely overblown, they will be fixed, and it was a necessary change no matter which way you cut it. They had to do it, and they had to do it at that point. So, that being said, I upgraded iOS 6, expecting smooth sailings, maybe a few problems with iOS maps. But I made a strategic error, and I had talked about this months ago when iOS 6 was, the developer preview came out, because there was this cool new app that Apple released with the developer preview. It was the podcasting app.
Mm-hmm.
And I during the show, I talked about it, I used it, I said it was pretty bad. Well, they updated it, they included it in iOS 6, the full iOS 6 came out, and I had reasoned that I hadn't heard any complaints about it, nobody was making a big deal about it on the web, so I figured, you know what, they must have fixed their stability issues, they it's probably a little bit quicker, I'm hearing great things about iOS 6, and I hate, you know, not being one of the cool kids with the latest technology, so I decided I'd take the plunge, and I'd get iOS 6. I downloaded it from my podcast, from my iPod Touch, works pretty quick, and I have to clarify here, because I used to own a classic iPod that I loved because it had tons and tons of storage on it. So I had like all my TV shows and movies and music. It was great. But the problem was, at the time, I had started listening to a lot of podcasts. And so what I would have to do is download the podcasts and at night or at the day. And I was like listening to daily podcasts and load it on my thing. And it was just sort of – it was difficult. So the idea of being able to download a podcast –
I think that SNL skit would have something to say about that, but go ahead.
Yes. So the idea of an iPod Touch where I could just download it, even though it was a significant reduction in my storage capacity, I felt like it was a fair trade-off. And so I ended up getting my first iPod Touch for free because I've never bought anything from Apple. And I don't think that's true anymore, but I can't remember what I bought. Probably headphones. I got my first iPod Touch and it worked great. I loved it. It did exactly what I needed it to do. It ended up, suffering a little bit of damage, water damage actually, at the hands of, my retirement investor. And I ended up getting a replacement one, which was very nice, and it's the latest model before this current one, the one that matches the iPhone 5. But I originally got it, and although I use it for browsing and playing games and listening to music, the primary reason I like it is because I can download podcasts. So podcasts are a big deal to me, and I realize that this is, you know, I might be a niche audience, but you get this new podcast app, I get the whole thing set up, and it doesn't work. Number one, it's slow as dirt. I mean, it is unbelievable how slow it is. It is so disappointing. It's just frustrating. Things aren't responsive. It doesn't move. It searches slow. Everything about it is slow. I mean, the rest of the phone is snappier. The rest of the device is snappier. It is actually snappier with iOS 6 than it was with late iOS 5, which is not normal. Usually, as you get the new operating system, the thing slowed down. So I was really impressed about that. That, wow, actually, it's everything moves quicker except the stupid podcasting app.
So why do you keep sticking with it? Why not just buy a third-party one for a couple bucks?
Because I did. That's the end of the story. I did. But this is the thing. I gotta give you – but
Okay,
this
yeah,
is
let
a
me hear
bigger
it.
story.
Sorry, I didn't mean to.
So I started going in, and so it's slow, which is frustrating. And one of the new words we learned this week was skeuomorphism. Apple helped everybody learn this new word because it's this big idea that skeuomorphism is bringing real life design into your high technology. So it's like if you have OS X and you have the calendar app, there's like leather trim on everything. That leather trim, the faux leather, the idea of making it
When you
seem
literally, when
real,
you,
like there's.
I don't know if it still does it. I haven't paid attention lately, but it used to be when you were in the month view and you were switching months, it would actually look like a sheet of paper tearing off.
Right. Well, yeah, it's actually it's the page flipping animation. That's called skeuomorphism. It basically is where you take, you try to have them reference real world activities. It makes it feel more real. And Steve Jobs is all about it. I mean, Steve
And easy to
Jobs is the
figure out, I
he was
guess,
the
right?
he yeah, and he absolutely loved it. The current dude who's in charge of the design, Scott Forstall, he's really big into it too. Johnny Ives, the guy who's in charge of making Apple devices look beautiful, hates it. He hates it with a passion. He thinks it's the worst thing
That's
that's ever happened. He always disagreed with Steve Jobs about it, and now that there's
awesome.
no Steve Jobs, they're talking about how the app designers are all getting angry at each other. Guys that are working for Scott Forstall are like, "Yeah, but Johnny Ives says," and Scott Forstall's like, "Yeah, but you work for me," and
That's
you know.
awesome.
And what's his name? Tim Cook is just having a hard time managing it all because the dude who had the ultimate, had the veto power is gone. And so it's just fun to watch, and it's interesting to see that there's this kind of dynamic coming up. But one of the apps that got this skeuomorphism treatment was this podcast app, because when you go through it and it's actually playing, there's this little reel-to-reel thing going on in the background, which it seems like that's the entire point of making the app, is they wanted the reel-to-reel thing, which is
It's
just
so
stupid. I
dumb.
mean, it's the stupidest. And the worst part about it is it's covered most of the time. And
Yeah.
Tufty, the dude who is like in charge of good design, good space management, how do you get the best information across? I'm sure it makes him want to weep with frustration, because it's basically you're taking all of your you could you were able to fit all of your what's the word I'm looking for? All of your pertinent information, where you are in the thing, your ability to scan, your ability to flip between, go backwards 30 seconds, go forward, your play, your pause, everything, all your information was there, and had good design. And now there's multiple pages of like you need to go through to if you want to scan this way, or if you want to do this, if you want, you just sit there and go, "I'm so frustrated by this, it's not even funny." It's terrible, terrible design. Okay, that's one thing. I can get over terrible design because it's just whatever and it looks nice. Some people like it. Okay, that was a design decision. But this is where it is unacceptable. It is just unacceptable. I listen to the Armstrong and Getty show every morning. They're awesome. If you guys ever listen to this show, please call us. We'll talk to you. We're pretty smart, and sometimes we talk about the things we talk about. And I love you. And yeah. Anyways, it's a great show. They do every hour of their radio show in the morning gets posted as a podcast,
Which is kind of
and
annoying, to
they've
be
been doing.
honest.
You know it is, but it's not. Yeah, I mean, what it was is they were actually posting them as the show was going, which
Huh.
nobody else does in radio. So they've recently stopped doing that because it was taking up too much time of their staff. So it's they're actually talk about moving it to like a single episode, which would be nice. But the thing is that. Currently, as it stands, is every day, 5 days a week for the last like 3 or 4 years, for the last 4 years, they have an archive of their podcasts. Their podcast list is enormous.
True.
And when you flip to it on the podcast, it freezes and then crashes. And I was curious about this. So I went to other podcasts with smaller lists. Other ones, it doesn't happen. Okay. Then I decided to get a little bit hinky. I decided to open up a bunch of apps really quickly, switch between them back to the podcast app, and try something with a mid-size, a lot of episodes, but not a huge number of episodes. Crashes. My podcast is running out of RAM, or my iPod Touch is running out of RAM with the podcast app. Because what they're doing is they're literally loading the entire list of podcasts. Now, they're not having the actual music, but just the list, with the link to this is the IP address of where you get the audio. That alone is enough to crash my iPod. Now, how usually you deal with this sort of thing is you load 10. You load the next 10. And then when you scroll down, you delete the each one that you pass through. You delete it, and then you load the next one. So if you scroll really fast, you'll just have blank spots. And then they'll suddenly populate as you're scrolling. But if you scroll at a normal rate, you won't notice any difference. That's how you do good memory management in that sort of a system. But no, they did that in the old app. The old app that was part of iTunes did that. They took that functionality out. They made the fundamental thing that the app does. They broke it. They broke my iPod. My iPod Touch does not work with this app. It blows my mind. And so I was super frustrated. Really irritated. Ended up buying a third-party app, which is whatever. It's like $2. But I couldn't believe that this is what you guys are designing. This is what you're doing. This is like one of the fundamental things that your thing does. And whatever. No, it's got the reel-to-reel animation. This is awesome. So it gets worse, though. Because I decided, you know what? Be a piece. Be zen-like. Maybe it's me. Maybe I'm an idiot. It's possible. I get pretty cocky about what I know. Maybe I'm an idiot. So I set up an appointment at the Apple store and decided to go in. I backed up my thing. I mean, I went through the whole thing and went to go and talk to them about it. Basically, we ran through the different things, the different failure. They saw it was failing, and they didn't have a solution. There was no fix. It's just a broken app. They know it's a broken app. There's nothing to do. It's just broken. And the worst part about it is it was working. That's what gets me, is it's like, you know, okay, I understand why you need to change something with the Google Maps. You took something that worked really well and you broke it because you added this new functionality of turn-by-turn navigation that you couldn't do with the Google system. I get that. I'm okay with that. That's an engineering decision. It's a difficult one, and you have to manage it. Okay. But this was just vanity. We wanted to have reel-to-reel, and we put bad engineers in charge of it. It's atrocious. It's completely unacceptable. And one of the things is that if that were it, okay, sometimes they make mistakes. Ping was a mistake. MobileMe was a mistake. I walked into I'm in the Apple store. They're telling me nothing works. Whatever. I've already figured out my new podcast app. Okay, I'm fine. You know, it's not that big of a deal. But they got the new iPod Touches there. I'm like, oh, awesome, new iPod Touches. Okay, cool. So I walk over to the iPod Touches, and they've got the little button thing in the back where you got the little hook. And I was like, I'm really excited about this. Like, it's, like, super light and it looks cool. And I open it up, and I go, like, let's play some Angry – there's no Angry Birds. There's nothing. There's nothing but the main apps. There's nothing but the standard apps.
Huh.
Sitting right next to it was the last generation iPod Touch, the one I have. I picked it up still full of all the different apps. And I was like, okay. So I walked over to the iPads. The iPads have all the apps. I walked over to the iPhone 5s. No apps but the standard apps. I walked over to the iPhone 4s's, the ones that they've had all along. They've got plenty of apps. They didn't put any apps on them for you to actually play with the new device. No apps.
That's weird.
Nothing outside of the standard stuff. No third-party games. Nothing for you to actually experience the app. Nothing to play around with. Just, oh, this is our product. Which I sit there and I go, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? And then, and like to make matters worse, like, you know, there's this big emotional thing. Steve Jobs died. You know, they had all these, like, you know, everybody was just like really, you know, like really torn up about it. Like, even on the show, you know, we were a little disrespectful because, hey, you know, sacred cows aren't fun. But at the same time, we, you know, we tried to be respectful of it and, you know, admiration for the man, whatever, you know. But at the same time, he's just a man. He made some products. You're like, I get that. But Apple was super reverent. Like, they gave people a week off. All their engineers had time off. I mean, like, it was like the man who was responsible for their jobs, for their living, for what their contribution to humanity died. And so they were really reverent about it. So they had this video at the year mark that was, like, supposed to be remembrance. And all it was Steve Jobs. Pictures of Steve Jobs showing off all the different products that Apple now sells. It's just a big ad. Remember Steve Jobs? These are the ad. These are the products that we made. You sit there and you go, you guys, like what you were famous for was the Think. What Steve Jobs was about was the Think Different campaign, where there's no product, just talking about genius, talking about what it means to partake in humanity, talking about why things are cool, talking about thinking different. Only reference to Apple was the stupid logo. I don't even know what products they were – actually, I do. But nobody knows what products they were selling at the time, because what he was selling was this experience, was what the company was about. Our company is about genius and catering to geniuses and catering to people who think different. And the products will – once they understand that that's what our product is about, they'll see it in our product and they'll buy our product. But no, new Apple wants you to just, look at the iPod Touch. Look at the iPad. Look at the iPhone. I know your stupid products. Everybody knows your products. Remind me why genius is fun. You know, I just like – I'm getting totally bent out of shape because it's like, you know – because Steve Jobs is gone. That's what it comes down to. Steve Jobs is gone, and it's bothering me a lot. Because the company that made it so exciting, and what made it so exciting was that Steve Jobs' attention to perfection, where he would have, you know, literally fired people over the podcasting app, and it would be fixed by now. It's a simple fix. It's not a difficult thing that they're doing. They already had it working. Just bring it back to parody, and you know, but whatever. You know, no, it's not that big of a deal.
That's my Android fanboy. That's what I like to hear.
I know. It's, well, you know,
you ought to see how well some of those podcast apps work on an Android device.
Yeah. I just couldn't believe it. It just is such a, you know, Apple's still a great company. They still have great products. They still have great engineers. They still do stuff, but they're definitely lost. They lost that little. They lost the last 5%. You know, they lost they're losing it. They're losing that thing that just made them clearly, obviously, this is the thing that you want. You don't want that other product. You know, and the problem is, and you know, yeah, this is me. This is my Google fanboyism coming out. Okay. Well, and I'll be even more fair than this. It's, you know, Microsoft doesn't have any skeuomorphism in the Windows Phone 8 or whatever they're on. The new Nokia phones, they're all about easy access and quick and fast design and good space management. You know, Apple's moving away from giving you the information you want and a tiny screen, and Microsoft is moving in the direction of giving you all the important information you want on a tiny screen. You sit there and you go, like, really? Really? You guys are going to let – that's the sort of thing that if it went long enough, Microsoft can't beat you, but you can let them beat you. You know, Google, that's something like, you know, and Google, they do a lot, or what they do, because they've given people freedom to do their own design, people are sitting there going, you know, I don't like this, so I'm just going to add this functionality. Oh, and this is the other thing about the podcasting app. The new podcasting app has this cool new thing. You can set a timer so it'll turn off after a certain amount of time, so you can fall asleep to it. It's something cool that a lot of people have asked for. I like that. Why didn't they build that into the timer app, where it just, you can set a snooze, you can set a sleep thing that will just turn off all music, that it will slowly lower the volume until the music turns off? Why isn't that a system-wide preference? Why is that in this one app that doesn't work? You see, like, what are you guys doing? This is, oh my gosh, I'm so frustrated by it, because it's like, and especially,
Windows Phone.
I realize that I'm over-exuberant right now, because they took away the reason I got the device. And
yeah, but you got a third-party app. You're good.
Well, you know, you say that. But the question that I have is, okay, how many third-party app replacements do you need to get? So now if you want a really good map, you got to get a third-party replacement. You want a good podcasting app, you got to get a third-party replacement. You know, like, how many of those do you need to go to? How many third-party replacements do I need before I say Apple software is not good enough for me? You know, you guys got, like, and you know, and I don't know, you know – it probably will be a long time before that really gets to where it's an obvious choice for somebody else. But it's like, you know, you had this impenetrable armor, and this, you know, and because people are stupid, this will affect their stock price. And, you know, and it'll seep its way into other products. And I'm also a little bit upset about the fact that they didn't send out announcements for the iPad mini this week. And I thought I was going to act like a genius on the show last week when I called it and it didn't happen. And I hate it when I'm wrong with my predictions. So
are they
that's
supposed
not their
to do
fault.
It this week or
they were supposed, well, every week they push the rumors are always it's 2 weeks from now. Oh. Now the rumor mill is they're going to announce it on the 28th, which or like the 23rd or something, which would be super frustrating. Well, it wouldn't be frustrating because I'm pretty sure I'm just not going to get it. I'm going to get my Kindle Paperwhite because that, you know, we talked if they announced it and launched it on like the 20th, then you could actually play with one and then I could make a decision whether I wanted my Kindle Paperwhite or nonsense. Amazon's not going to ship it till the 5th, even though I ordered it on the 2nd of October. Frustrated with that too, but that's, you know, whatever. That's just normal frustration. That's not anger.
All right. So I'm going to bring it back.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry to hear that your week was not awesome.
Yeah. Everything's amazing and nobody's happy.
I got one last one, unless you have one more that you're just like, no, I absolutely have to talk
no.
about this.
No, I'm glad I left that till the end, and I needed to get that out, but
cool.
Let's close on a happier note.
So there was a teenage hacker. They don't actually know who the person is, so I don't know how they know it's a teenager, but yeah, sure, what the heck. He goes by the username of Pinkie Pie, which is a reference to the My Little Pony TV show.
Oh, jeez. He's a brony.
Oh, yeah. apparently he found a vulnerability within Chrome.
Yeah.
And Google kind of has a policy where it's like, you know, whenever they like hold competitions and do stuff like that, if you find some sort of critical vulnerability, they will pay you for it. They set aside like $2 million to do it.
Ooh.
And so, Pinkie Pie won himself $60,000 for
holy
finding
cow.
His critical error. Oh yeah, by the way, it's not his first one.
Really?
Yeah. It's the SVG use after free and IPC arbitrary file write.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
Yeah. Hey, right, okay, right. I understood some of those words. Some of those letters, really.
The files, yeah. It's a browser. There's no files.
Right.
So kudos to Pinkie Pie for finding some bugs. I think it's cool that Google's willing to, you know, pay developers money to make their stuff more secure. They're not developers,
brilliant.
But to pay people.
Well, they're crowdsourcing and they're giving you they're crowdsourcing improvements because a lot of times, you know, that sort of stuff does come from,
mm-hmm.
you know, from the outside. And they're giving you the best part about it is they're giving you a reason to not abuse it for financial gain because there's financial gain for being honest about it without the, you know, problems of it being illegal by abusing it. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's brilliant on their part. They're basically, you know, the stick is it's illegal and now, you know, to abuse what you've found. And now the carrot is, oh yeah. And you'll get paid 60 grand and won't have to work for the next year. You know, or you can play a lot of World of Warcraft or whatever. We don't really care. That was me. He probably doesn't play World of Warcraft. He's probably smarter than that. Of course, he does watch My Little Pony, so I don't know.
There's balance. You may not be solving Chrome, you know, hack vulnerabilities, but you're not watching My Little Pony. So.
Yeah, so mission accomplished, really. As far as I'm concerned, that was a good day.
Yeah.
I hope we don't have any My Little Pony fans in the audience. You know what? Whatever. We
this
make fun of
podcast
everybody.
Isn't for everybody.
Yeah, we could say, go away.
Yeah, cool. Awesome. Well, I'd ask if there's anything going on in your life, but I think we already got that story.
Yeah, that's it.
Patience.
That was what was going on in my life.
Yeah. Very cool. All right, man. Hey, good talk. I'm kind of shocked that we got through everything.
Yeah, me too. It was exciting.
It was fast.
Oh, by the way, congratulations, Felix Bumgardner, for, we briefly mentioned it, but he, like, jumped 23 miles or something, which is pretty cool. So.
Yeah, that's really high. It looked really high on the video.
Yeah, it gave me a serious sense of vertigo just watching.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. That's unreal.
Okay. Yeah, that's pretty neat. All right, cool. Well, everybody, thank you for joining us. My name is James Furlow, and my high-flying brother is Matthew Furlow. And we will talk next time. Boom, I heard the beep. I heard it again.
You heard the beep. I didn't hear the beep. What the heck? This ain't fair. It's hard for me to tell.
Sorry.
Are we live?